Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to the Gallipoli Club and Scott Heathwood for making this facility possible. It's a great facility, and if you want to hang around for a drink or something to eat, that can happen later downstairs. Today we're here for the launch of Anne Henderson's book, Menzies at War, covering essentially the first Menzies government of 1939 to 1941. Very pleased that Barry O'Farrell can launch this, so I will introduce him briefly, followed by a brief introduction of the other two speakers, and then we'll proceed until the book is launched and it's all over. So Barry O'Farrell is here for a number of reasons. He's been a member of Parliament since 1995. He's the former, as you know, the former Premier of New South Wales. But I guess he's here today because he's a long-term member of and supporter of the Sydney Institute and one of the best-read politicians that I've ever come across in my career. So Barry O'Farrell is here because he's an important commentator on contemporary and historical Australia. Anne Henderson will then respond to Barry O'Farrell's comments, and after we hear from Mr. O'Farrell and Anne Henderson, Philippa McGuinness, who is the executive publisher at UNSW Press, will say a few words, and then we'll wind up, and the book's available for anyone who wants to buy it. So Barry O'Farrell, thank you, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Jared. Most people learn from their mistakes, their failures, their defeats, even politicians. And at times you get a second chance to show that you've learned those lessons. And at the heart of Menzies at War, Anne Henderson provides an insight into how Australia's most successful federal MP set about recovering from his first short, unhappy stint as Australia's Prime Minister. But this book offers more than this tale of redemption. It provides a skillfully researched and written and a compelling account of an important decade in the nation's history. And along the way, Anne Henderson demolishes a few myths and a few left-wing historians to boot. Is it any wonder that Anne and Jared, for their intellectual rigour, are being compared to Beatrice and Sidney Webb? When you read this book, you'll marvel at the parallels to be drawn between these political events and those of more recent times. And again, you'll understand the lessons that history can teach. For instance, Anne describes the dysfunction of a minority government in a hung parliament. An aloof, some said arrogant leader, while focused on national and international issues, forgets the first rule of politics, engage your team. The internal party white-anting of a Prime Minister and the jockeying for leadership of others. And, of course, the betrayal of government and their electorates by two Conservative MPs who opt to support a Labor government. Who says history is dull? This is a sort of political thriller, even if you know the endings of the story before you buy one on your way out today. For those who think that factionalism and personality-driven politics are recent barnacles on our democratic system, this book will give you cause to rethink your views. It includes perhaps one of the most outrageous public attacks, motivated, of course, by personal malice, upon a Prime Minister by any factional leader in our history. Earl Page's claim that Menzies lacked the courage, loyalty and leadership to be Prime Minister. Page effectively called Menzies a coward for not serving in World War I, and he did so at a time when the wounds of that conflict still greatly affected families across the nation. He did so at a time when it was clear to most that we were soon to be at war again. And to emphasise his message, Page then took the Country Party out of the coalition leaving Menzies to lead a minority government. Compared to Will Page, Don Farrell, Paul Howes, Mark Abib were mere pussies. And speaking of warriors, consistent with the Henderson way, Anne doesn't miss either as she shines a spotlight on the people and events described in Menzies at War. With the benefit of the personal insights provided in Heather Henderson's wonderful books on Menzies' family life, Anne makes short work of Judith Brett's Freudian interpretation and claims of unresolved family conflict being the basis of Menzies' character and political outlook. In these days of selfies, of Twitter, of talkback, it's hard to remember that once politicians could opt out of having a spotlight shone on their families and even had time to consider their views before launching them on unsuspecting public. Importantly, for historical accuracy and the reputation of Menzies' first government, Anne also rejects Stuart McIntyre's claim that the UAP failed to equip Australia to meet the challenges of the coming Second World War. Using her detailed knowledge of the Lyons government, and there's a second book you can buy, and the subsequent Menzies administration covered in this volume, Anne sets the record straight, pointing to Lyons and Menzies' efforts to secure what today is Australia's most important strategic alliance, of course, that with the United States of America. Another of the book's highlights is its recounting of the interaction between Churchill and Menzies during that 1941 ill-fated visit to England. Claims that Menzies spent a good part of his time trailing his coat to try and supplant Churchill might have sold a few other books, but the lack of evidence for such a notion is again exposed here. As are more corrosive claims that Menzies and his government didn't do enough to champion to Churchill and the War Cabinet the defence needs of this region. Now, on his way to England in 1941, Menzies actually stopped over in Singapore and saw firsthand the lame defences of that outpost and described in his diaries what he said was the ignorance of the generals about the threat they faced. So it's not surprising to learn again that he devoted much of his time during that long trip to England to get Churchill to address our region's defence needs. Menzies even extended his trip against the advice of those back home who said it would do him political damage. Now, it's true he wasn't successful, but Anne Henderson writes it wasn't because he didn't try. Also made clear by Anne Henderson is the fact that Menzies was a man of his time. Whether in the pre-war period when, like Curtin and most Australians, he was supportive of every effort to try and avoid a repeat of the 1914-18 killing of fields, or in the post-war years when he pursued what Anne describes as a commitment to a harmonious, safe and prosperous Australia. It should be obvious to all that someone who won 7 elections was not only popular with, but in tune with the electorate. It should be obvious, but apparently not obvious to those on the left who continue to disparage Menzies and his achievements, representing him all too often as some sort of imperial dinosaur. Now, that's hard to reconcile with a man whose government established the Colombo Plan, whose government introduced the first no-fault divorce system in this country, and who provided access to a university education to hundreds of thousands of young Australians through the establishment of the Commonwealth Education Scholarship Scheme. A scheme that some of those who criticise him actually benefited from. Now, I'd argue that Menzies' subsequent successes and achievements are all down to the period that Anne Henderson covers in this book, because this is, above all, a book about rejection, reassessment and recovery. It tells the story of Menzies' resignation as Prime Minister and the personal and public blow to ego and pride that accompanies such a decision. But it also describes how, after a couple of months of self-doubt and uncertainty, Menzies picked himself up and started on the second, more successful stage of his federal career. He reassessed his political beliefs and, through radio, set about communicating them to the public. The use of commercial radio and not the beloved ABC was regarded as a clever and novel manoeuvre. Perhaps it was the equivalent of Kevin Rudd's use of social media in the lead-up to the 2007 election campaign, although one suspects that Menzies could use a radio broadcast to be far more direct than Kevin Rudd using 140 characters. Next, Menzies took back his party, firstly regaining the party leadership and then setting about creating a new political party. Now, one of my former colleagues who is with us today, and it's not Andrew Tink, was fond of saying in jest that he was never a member of an organised political party, just the New South Wales Liberal Party. But it's worth remembering that the structure that Menzies put in place in 1945 has largely survived both the passage of time and the attempts of various power brokers to manipulate it. It's the structure that's delivered the Federal Liberal Party more years in power than in opposition. And then Menzies tackled the really hard part, winning elections. But having lost his first as Liberal leader in 1946, he wasn't to look back and will remain an exception, if an oddity, in Australian federal politics. One of only two Prime Ministers to choose his own time of leaving the job. Menzies has been a favourite of mine for many years. His resilience and persistence, as described in this good book, was certainly a comfort when, along with others in this crowd, we sat through 16 long years of opposition in the state parliament. His philosophy, of course, resonated, but so too his pragmatism. It's said that Menzies once opined that it must be great to be an ideologue. It saves time thinking. And the fact is that he believed that as circumstances changed, so too should your approach to an issue. He was not about applying yesterday's fix to tomorrow's problem. Like him, I also firmly embraced the view that the Liberal Party should represent those who weren't organised, those who didn't have a voice, those ignored and unrepresented by the unions and big business, the so-called Menzies, famous forgotten people. But above all, I remain attracted to Menzies because he is a great Australian success story, a reminder of the opportunities that this country has always offered to individuals. The boy from the small country town, through dint of scholarship and hard work, ends up a leader of the Victorian Bar. That's that colony just south of the river. Spends 6 years in that colonial parliament, ending up to be deputy premier, and then embarks on a federal career of 32 years, ending up as the longest serving prime minister in the nation's history. If that's not redolent of the opportunities that exist in this country, whether to someone born in the 1890s or those born overseas coming to this country today, nothing is. It's a great story. It's a great story about a liberal politician. Winston Churchill, of course, said that history will be kind to me because I intend to write it. And he did, with prodigious effort and prodigious results. The pity is that Menzies wrote too little. But with the help of people like Alan Martin and Heather Henderson and others, we've started to fill the void. So too this volume by the redoubtable Anne Henderson. This is a book that fills in some blanks. This is a book that corrects the errors of others. But also, it's a book that importantly reminds us of the real character and genius of a man called Robert Gordon Menzies. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming, and thank you for coming, Barry. It is lovely to have someone who is not only a practitioner of politics, but also a truly lover of books. And Janet Grundy, who's sitting here selling our books, was a bespoke bookseller to our former Premier of New South Wales. And thank you very much, Barry. Yes, I think Barry said most of what should be said, and I haven't got much to say in addition, except to remind everyone that the big anniversary this year, apart from the 70th anniversary for the founding of the Liberal Party, but the big anniversary this year is that this year marks 75 years since Robert Menzies became Prime Minister of Australia. And nobody's saying anything about that. 75 years of a century, our greatest Prime Minister, and this is his moment. Why won't you hear about this anniversary? And the reason is, and the Liberal Party faithful have probably got a bit to be cautioned about for this, is that no one's interested in the achievements of Bob Menzies Mark 1. He's been written off as a failure as a Prime Minister in his first time round, and the Labor historians have pretty much set the whole myth in operation. Yesterday on Richard Glover, we were having a wonderful interview. I was getting a tremendous amount of time, and Richard had read the book, and it was a really good engagement. And suddenly, out of the blue, he says to me, Anglophile. Robert Menzies must have been an Anglophile, because he went to Britain in 41 and tried to get a seat in the House of Commons. And I just said, no, that's a complete myth. Someone tried to get him a seat after he'd lost office, but he never went to London in 1941 to try and get a seat in the House of Commons. So that's how the myths hang on. Robert Menzies came to office in 1939 in April after the sudden death of Joe Lyons. Joe Lyons, who had left the Labor Party, had become the folksy Prime Minister of the Depression years of Australia, had suddenly died after a long illness that nobody knew much about, very much similar to Curtin, who died of heart failure. And he came to office at a time when it was dramatically sad and a huge upheaval for the country. Yet in 2.5 years, he had gone. He had resigned. And was seen then as the demise of a greatly talented figure of politics and the bar, who had failed at the helm all too soon. Now, that demise has coloured the memories of Robert Menzies Mark I, and failure doesn't sit well with the image of Australia's longest-serving and most successful Prime Minister. This erudite, prize-winning lawyer from Melbourne's Selborne Chambers, with his smart rejoinders and cutting wit and a broad-shouldered approach to politics both at home and abroad. Yet it was this early demise of Robert Menzies Mark I that helped more than anything to mould the man who became Robert Menzies Mark II. This set in place a leader who outlived his political opponents and gave Australia a healthy dose of even-handed prosperity along with an abhorrence of politics of the extreme. Robert Menzies came to politics on a dream run, a successful albeit self-made lawyer and barrister who moved quickly through Victorian state politics to the federal seat of Kooyong and became Attorney General at the age of 39, which was no mean feat in those days. But the Menzies style of being a little too clever in a country that cuts down tall poppies, and moreover, as I discovered as I read more and more, well-connected in Melbourne business circles, so much so that his backers and his strong advisers were outside of parliamentary politics. This, alongside with his tendency to quick-witted backhanding his opponents and even colleagues he disagreed with, left Menzies with a reputation for being aloof and unpopular with ordinary voters. There's a story that Percy Spender captured in his Politics in a Man, and it tells of a night during those years when he was Prime Minister the first time around, maybe 1940, 1941, when they were having dinner in Parliament House, Spender, Menzies, a couple of others, and a colleague from the Senate who had found Menzies aloof and hard to talk to had warmed to him on this occasion, and at the end of the dinner as they were leaving, he said to Menzies, why couldn't he be more like that more often? He gave off the impression that he didn't suffer fools gladly. To which Robert Menzies replied without taking breath, and what do you think I'm doing now? I worked out it could have been Senator Foll, and Spender says that he was one of the first to try and get Menzies to resign at the meeting when he did finally offer his resignation afterwards. But for all that, Menzies Mark I was a standout. As a standout as a successor to Lyons, in fact, his impatience to get the job was very much reminiscent of Costello and Howard. The UAP did want an unpopular leader at the time, but he had all the attributes of what you would regard as good political leadership. He had mastery of political debate and leadership gravitas, which the UAP was very much lacking at the time. But he was also ahead of his time in being not an Anglophile, but our first truly internationalist PM. He wanted to travel the world, not to go and see the cricket in London so much as to be in touch firsthand, as younger politicians do today, to get their fingers on the whole ambience of what global politics is about. While Labour-leaning critics have all too often tagged Menzies as Anglophile, almost at times of accusing him of not really being Australian, with nothing, he was really a leader who walked the global stage as it was in his era. Remember, this was the time of the British Empire. It wasn't G20 and all the rest of it. It was really much the Dominions and Britain. Britain ruled the waves, and Australia was happy with its Dominion status. Robert Menzies' accession as Australia's 12th Prime Minister in April 1939 came with drama. But added to all of that were the rivalries and tensions of a party that had been in office for so long, one cobbled together in 1931 to meet a financial crisis, and one where many ambitions and many egos thought that they could have the spot that Lyons was going to vacate. And in amongst this was the old former Labor leader, Billy Hughes, against whom Menzies only narrowly won the leadership when they voted in April 1939. So that tells you something of the mess the UAP was in, particularly from New South Wales, which, as Barry referred to, was always a bit of a mess. The animosity of Earl Page, which Barry has described, led to the Country Party leaving the coalition, and even Earl Page trying between the vote to make Menzies leader of the UAP and his accession to PM. Some weeks they had to wait because Page put it off, being the acting PM. He tried to get Stanley Bruce to come back from his position as High Commissioner in London and form some kind of national government. Nobody really knew what he was offering, not even Bruce, but that didn't happen. So technically, in April 1939, Menzies took the reins of a minority government with Governor-General Lord Gowrie asking the new PM how long he thought his administration would last, to which Menzies answered, tongue-in-cheek, 6 weeks. For all that, it performed well. Even got through the 1940 election, scraped home enough to continue governing. And this was all with a fractious team and facing a fractious Labor Party. It was bad times for politics all round. But there were many achievements. I'll give just a few. The National Register, which Labor campaigned strongly against, embarking Australian troops in their thousands beginning January 1940 for the Middle East, and then troop commitments to many theatres of war, including from Europe to Malaysia. The reorganisation of industry and the revamp of federal departments for a war government all took place under Menzies. And if you want a better summary of all of that, read Hal Kolbach's review in Quadrant this month, which, fortunately for me, is fantastic, and you'll get even more information. So it was were years of frustration, and Britain, we have to remember at that point, stood alone. No America, only its dominions. And Hitler came very close, and maybe it was only thanks to the end of the Nazi-Soviet pact that stopped him from actually taking London itself. And there was only Churchill, in his bulldog way, was obsessed, naturally, with protecting his own back, and he couldn't see the need for the Dominions equally. Alongside all of this, Australians had very mixed feelings about going to another war. As the AIF marched through Sydney's streets to embark in at the beginning of 1940, there was as much regret as any feeling of patriotism or support for the war effort, unlike 1914. So Menzies lived out those years of government in his first term, surrounded on all sides, a disunited team behind him, an opposition opposed to any proposal for government of national unity, apparent indifference to Australia's plight at the Empire's heart, and his 4 month trip to the UK, where he went through all sorts of hoops and hurdles, stood up to Churchill in the War Cabinet, went off to Ireland, sadly to try and convince de Valera to soften his approach to Britain. That was a fool's errand. None of this helped him get what he wanted. And the moves towards that period in August 1941, when Menzies just threw in the towel, were also dramatic. And I've included in the back of the book an account that Menzies himself wrote a few days afterwards of what happened, and it's never been published before, and it's very revealing. Even the fact that he can sort of add a little wit every now and then to the way in which it happened. When he left Parliament House the night that he finally retired as leader of the party, he had tears in his eyes, hanging on to his personal secretary, Cecil Looker, quoting from an old Scottish ballad, "Lay me down and bleed a while, and then I'll rise and fight again." And as I could see it, this was a broken heart, but not a broken man. And he did go on and fight again, even though some, and this is where some of this furphy about him trying to get a seat in Whitehall comes about, Governor-General Lord Gowrie and the UK High Commissioner in Canberra at the time made efforts to get him back into the war, to do something. You remember Richard Casey was conscripted to go and work with the British in the Middle East in 1942. And they made representations on Menzies' behalf to try and get him a post, a British post, because no one imagined that he would go any further in politics. He even tried, Menzies was even prepared to go to Washington when Richard Casey resigned in 42, but of course the Labour Party stopped that because Churchill suggested it. Now, when he did resume the leadership of the UAP after the Labour landslide, the biggest one ever, in 1943 federal election, he assumed the leadership, but he was still very uncertain as to what he really wanted in politics. And thanks to John Paul, who's here somewhere, a little cherub of information has come to light, never before known. Menzies allowed his name to go forward to the Victorian government to be selected as the Chief Justice of Victoria. But of course, it was Country Party Premier Albert Dunstan who didn't get on with Menzies, and he failed in that attempt too. So 1944 became an amazing year. Menzies went on with others to form the Liberal Party. And from there, they went on to the 1946 election, which they didn't win. Menzies thought that he was doing very well. He was now surrounded by people who seemed to love him and whatever, but they were mostly on his side. So the 1946 election came as a bit of a shock. And then in 1947, Chifley decided to extend the wartime powers and nationalise the banks. And that, as they say, made the history that followed. Menzies grabbed his opportunity. There was a huge campaign by the banks, and he went to Victoria for the state election, which was where he was very successful in looking like he was led the Liberals back into office. And then, of course, the High Court rejected the legislation when it was taken on appeal by a group opposing it, and it went all the way to the Privy Council. And in the middle of all this, the gorgeous Bert Evatt, who wanted to be the centre of attention most of his political life, and he stood in these legal assemblies, the courts in Britain, the courts in Australia, annoyed the hell out of his chief justices, of the justices that he was appearing before, and eventually it took 2 years before that legislation was struck down, found to be not lawful. And by then, you're leading up to the 1949 election, and by then, Menzies has got the electorate eating out of his hand. So in all of this, the Liberal Party took shape, gained focus, and in all of this that I've been writing, I have to say thanks, a huge thanks, to Heather Henderson, for after years of the Menzies family being very coy about what they allow people to read of a personal nature, she has, through her letters, the letters that her father wrote to her when she was a young married woman and travelling with Peter in the Foreign Affairs Service, and more recently her memoir, she has brought to light a personality that Menzies really was, just like anybody else, a person who had his failings, had his strength, and who was a loving dad, and who revealed and has revealed in many letters to his son just how much he withstood the downs and took charge of the ups like any other person, but also what a remarkable person he was to have come back in the way he did. I hope the book's filled a lot of gaps. That's what it's all about, filling the gaps. History's a wonderful thing. You think it's all done and dusted, and then suddenly out of the blue comes more. I'd like to thank Philippa McGuinness, who stood with me from the beginning and put up with me in my cranky moments, and the team at New South Publishing, and thank you all for coming.
So finally, Philippa McGuinness from UNSW Press. Thank you, Philippa.
Thank you. Thank you, Jared, for giving me the opportunity to speak, and Anne for your kind words. But my main task now is to thank Barry O'Farrell, who, as you all know, is making his first appearance for some time. And what an appearance it was. He's clearly a very insightful and sympathetic reader of Menzies at War. And as I sat here listening, I thought that has to come from his own personal experience of the difficulties, the challenges, the vagaries, dare I say, of leadership. And so I know that I'm speaking for everyone here when I thank you for being such a sympathetic, thoughtful reader of what is a very important book. I also want to make a very brief comment about the work that Anne has done as a historian. We have a very extensive and serious and active program in publishing Australian history at UNSW Press, New South Publishing. And one of the things that I respect and admire very much about Anne Henderson's work is her commitment to telling stories that people think they know but don't really know about the period of politics in mid-20th century Australia. And her skill and her own insights, her hard yakka with research, is very important and valuable. And I know that you'll all join with me in congratulating her for the work she's done on Menzies at War.
So many thanks to Barry O'Farrell for another wonderful performance at the Sydney Institute. He recently gave a couple of terrific speeches introducing speakers at our annual dinner, so he's back again tonight, and many thanks for that. Thanks to Anne for her book, and to Philippa for publishing it. And you're all welcome to hang around the Gallipoli Club, and we'll see you next time. Anne will probably have another book out in half an hour or a couple of months. We might just hang around and wait for it. But thanks for coming along today.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.